You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 38, Future Time Cops. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Norman Spinrad's lost TOS script, Dayton Ward's new TOS novel, That Which Divides, TNG Mounted Memories, new Star Trek busts, and lots of movie news and rumors. Then, in the feature, we're joined by Charlene Schmidt and J.D. Onassi of the Delta Quadrant podcast as we discuss the Voyager episode, Future's End. So, let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I'm doing great, Chris. I may have been up until about 4 a.m. last night, but I am ready to step into the Ready Room.
Yeah, what was that you told me? Now, you put yourself in geosynchronous orbit around Seattle yesterday. Is that what was going on?
That is what was going on. I made a loop. I made several loops, actually, around the city, and then I stayed up entirely too late. But, you know, it's the weekend, Chris, and that's basically what you have to do when you're young and you're in the city. What about you? How have you spent your weekend?
Nothing too special around here. I think we had a birthday party for our uncle, and just the usual stuff, really. So nothing special. I did a nice brisk walk this morning and ready to talk about Star Trek. So, now you may notice in the camera, of course, listeners can't see me, but you know, if you can see what I'm wearing today, I have a plan for this. I didn't just choose this by accident. I'm going to take some photos of myself, and I'm going to leak them out on the internet, especially going to try to get them into the hands of MTV if I can, and see if I can get some speculation going, you know, about whether this is a new uniform design for the upcoming J.J. Abrams Star Trek movie.
It's very fancy. I'm a big fan of what you got going there. Now, is that comm badge, can you tap it to, is it an actual comm badge, or is it just decorative?
Well, it's supposed to be decorative, but as it turns out, I can tap it and communicate with other ships because apparently in Star Trek, you can tap it any comm badge now. I think even the fabric ones in the original series, apparently,
right.
At least if you're in comic form, you could tap those too.
Well, I was watching yesterday's Enterprise, and somebody just tapped their 23rd century comm badge, and it just worked. So I'm just thinking, maybe they just didn't realize you could tap it. Like, they kept carrying around these communicators.
That's right.
The Starfleet engineers were like, guys, you know, we build it into the combat. Like, no. No, we like the communicator. We like the communicator.
Yeah, it just makes us feel comfortable that we have this big object, you know, hanging off our belt all the time. Yeah, I know. It's like, then somebody's reaching for something. They accidentally bump their chest into a table and it chirps.
Right.
Like, wait, you mean we could have been tapping these all these years?
I could have been tapping my chest for months now.
Oh, all right. Well, Greg, before we jump into actual news today, we're going to do our mailbag segment. We have one interesting message, and we're going to do that first. And also want to give a shout out to a couple of people, actually, who left us reviews on iTunes. And before we do that, Greg, I wanted to give a shout out to our friends at Dork Trek, because you and I think we've been a little bit behind in overall podcast listening, and we finally both made it to the Deja Q episode recently, in which the Dork Trek crew gave us quite a shout out. And
they definitely
did. Yeah, I just want to say thanks for that. And we really enjoyed the episode and, of course, all the Dork Trek shows. So thanks, guys, for that. And encourage everyone, if you want a really fun take on TNG, definitely go to iTunes and subscribe to Dork Trek, and you'll have a blast.
Yes, it's the most fun you'll have listening to a Star Trek podcast. I'm not saying we're not fun, but they're more fun. Just trust me on this one.
Absolutely. All right. And speaking of iTunes, now, Greg, we had two more 5-star reviews for the Ready Room posted on the US iTunes site. And one of them is from McBlakemore1970. Now, I'm not sure if the 1970 refers to this person's year of birth or if that's the code for the self-destruct aboard their starship. It would be a little bit trickier than the usual. 000, destruct, zero. But either way, the number's in there. And they said that I look forward to listening every week. I especially like the chemistry between the two hosts. They also have news about the new movie, like how much trouble Christopher Pine is causing on the set. Wink. So that's catching on. Now, I'm not sure if they're talking about us, Greg, or if they're referring to Mike and Dan.
Yeah, Mike and Dan were chemistry. Great. Did you hear that show? I didn't go back and listen until recently, but no, Mike and Dan's show was fantastic. They were on point.
They were, and I mean, I think it was Colin in the UK who actually said that Mike and Dan seemed like they had done this kind of thing before. So,
yeah.
We really appreciate them filling in for us there, and hopefully, we'll bring them back sometime.
Yeah, I think they're going to be our co-host when we start doing animated series episodes.
Yes. Okay. Well, we had one other one. This is from Asian16, which. Again, I don't know if they were born in 1916 or if there are 16 of them or where the 16 comes from. They were the 16th person with the name Asian to sign up for an iTunes account.
There you go.
At any rate, they said, I heard about this podcast through another great one called Technologic, and I've just begun listening to the episodes. I find that the hosts work well together and the atmosphere is very friendly. They thoroughly prepare the news and background information, so each episode is informative. Great guests from the Star Trek world round out the show. And on the Trek FM forum, I enjoy the trivia, polls, and newsletter very much. I'm glad I found out about this podcast, and I would definitely recommend it to any fan looking for an in-depth info and commentary. So, big thanks for that one to Asian16.
I'm glad to hear that people think our chemistry is good and the atmosphere is relaxed, because personally, I've been feeling pretty uncomfortable with this whole thing over the past few months, and I didn't want to. I'm glad that no one else is realizing, but I think there's a lot of tension right now on the Trek FM set.
Well, I think it's that Chris Pine influence, you know, that's coming in, and I'm always worried, you know, that you're going to try to punch me in the face, but fortunately, we're on opposite side of the worlds,
right. And
you don't want to damage your display, so. You know, I feel like I'm probably okay there, but
I did have your stunt double flyover, so I was able to punch him a couple times.
Well, that's what he's there for. I mean, that's why we have that budget for him to fly around the world, so people can punch him. I will point out there too, Asian16 here mentions Technologic, and that's another great Star Trek podcast that I listen to. And if you want to have another fun discussion, then definitely check out Technologic, and you'll find them in iTunes as well. And there's so many good Star Trek podcasts out these days, Greg.
Yeah, I'm trying to get caught up on all of them, and it's a little hard. I know Dork Trek is a must listen. Delta Quadrant I'm starting to listen to as well. So I need to start adding some of these other shows. There's a huge Star Trek world out there that, you know, just the tip of the iceberg right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It is hard to keep up for sure. One more thing, Greg, before we get into news. We had some mail from Renee Roberts in Germany. And I think this is directed largely at you, Greg. Renee says that referring to the plush Kirk idea that you tossed out, just let me quote, Kirk isn't soft. Kirk may be a swaggering, overbearing, tin-plated dictator with delusions of godhood, but he's not soft. Well, except maybe when there's a pretty skirt to be chased. Great show. Keep up the good work. Live long and prosper, Renee.
All right.
So just need to make sure that you know Kirk is not soft.
Okay, Kirk's not soft. Yes. Only solid plastic action figures for James T. Kirk.
Yes. All right. So thanks for the mail, Renee, and everyone for the iTunes reviews. So Greg, what do we have up first in news this week?
Yeah, we actually have, crazily enough, some original series news, which I can't remember the last time we had news about the original series, seeing how it's been off the air for about, 23, 24 years at this point.
Yeah. It's and especially these days with the J.J. Abrams reboot, it seems that everything from that time period coming out is pretty much Abramsverse related.
Yeah, exactly. But this is basically a lost script for the original series. It's Norman Spinrad, who wrote The Doomsday Machine, which is one of my personal favorites. We were talking to Larry Nemechek. That's one of his favorite episodes of the original series as well. And this is an episode he wrote, I'm not actually sure for which season. It was the second or third season of the show, right?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly, but yeah, something along those lines.
What sort of details do we have? I mean, it's come to light recently. It was lost for years. What happened to it?
I think someone used it to line the bottom of their bird cage. That's what usually happens when things like this get lost. I don't know what really happened to it. Now, it was originally written, as I understand it, it was commissioned by Gene Roddenberry, and it was going to be like a vehicle for Milton Berle as a serious actor. But of course, he was known more for humor. And once Spinrad wrote the script, it got over to Gene Kuhn, and Gene Kuhn started rewriting it and basically turned it into what they have called an unfunny comedy, basically. It's kind of this feeling. It kind of reminded me like when Jason Alexander was on Voyager, and you kind of heard that Jason Alexander was going to be on Voyager, and you knew him as George Costanza from Seinfeld, and you felt, I think a lot of people felt like, well, how can he be on there? He's, you know, he's a comedian, whereas actually Jason Alexander is a very good stage actor too and could do very serious roles. And I guess in this case, Gene Kuhn felt that Milton Berle couldn't do the serious role, or that it would play better if it were a comedy. Started changing it. Spinrad told Gene that this isn't going to work. We can't do this. And Gene Roddenberry agreed, and they just never shot the script. And then it just kind of disappeared from there.
Yeah. So I guess basically this was in the days of you'd type it up on the typewriter, give it to the studio, and you just wouldn't have a copy anymore. And so Spinrad assumed, you know, after Gene Kuhn rewrote everything, that his original script was just lost, that he'd never see it again. He managed to get the new script, you know, excised. It never did get made, thankfully, apparently. But he just assumed until recently that it was gone for good, until at a convention when a fan actually brought him a copy of the script to sign, which must have been quite a shock for him.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, he said a fan brought him a faded copy. And so he signed it, and he autographed it, and then the fan sent him a PDF scan of the script.
Fantastic.
It's amazing how that turned out. And now you can get it actually from Amazon. I did buy it. I haven't read the whole script yet, but I did get it. It's a little bit expensive actually for
really?
For a loss. It's $9 on Kindle.
Wow.
But it seemed very interesting, so I did grab it.
Actually, funnily enough, there was a tweet by Larry Nemechek, friend of the show, who said that actually he's known about this script for years and that it's been floating around at conventions. It's crazy that people knew about it, but somehow the author never found out that it actually was still available, because it was very much under the radar.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's a case of if you're at the conventions. I mean, I don't think Norman Spinrad is typically at Star Trek conventions, you know, not all the different conventions. And so if you are there, you know, like Larry is always around at these places, maybe you're a little bit more privy to those little stories that are circulating.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but this isn't even all the story. I mean, so far what you said is already a pretty big news story, and it all happened since the last show we recorded. But there's even more news about this lost script.
Yeah, now this came out. This is interesting and exciting that Phase 2, which I think most fans are aware of as the fan series, they're producing original series era episodes. They used to be called New Voyages, changed their name a while back to Phase 2. Producer of Phase 2, James Cawley, he contacted Norman Spinrad, and they talked about producing the script and doing an actual episode. And Cawley offered Spinrad the opportunity to direct the episode, and reportedly he's accepted that, and they're going to actually produce this story, which is called, I don't think we mentioned the name yet.
We didn't.
He Walked Among Us.
So that's, I mean, that's fantastic to actually see a lost script. This isn't the first time, I think, that a lost script has been made. Was it Of Gods and Men, I believe, was also an unfilmed script for the original series that has been made. I could be wrong about this. Maybe. This is my understanding. So they're really trying to honor the original series heritage in this fan film series. And this one I'm definitely excited to see.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. It's, again, shows how Star Trek endures, that something like this can float around all these years. And then because of fans, it's able to resurface.
Yeah.
And hopefully Spinrad's original vision can be realized now.
Yeah, it's quite exciting. We need to go back and watch all these Phase 2 episodes and then actually do a show about them. I've seen a couple here and there, and they are very good. It's very high quality, and it's actually quite impressive what they're able to do on a fan film budget.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's a good idea. We should get those all together and prep a show for that. Okay, so we'll have more news on that as it develops, and we'll see when it's going to go into production and when we might be able to see the episode. So, Greg, while we're talking about stories, I have one more thing I want to throw in here. We just mentioned how so much of the news these days about the TOS era is Abramsverse related. But Dayton Ward, the Star Trek author, has a new novel coming out today, in fact, which is a TOS story that is set in the Prime timeline with Captain Kirk and Spock and everyone as we know them. And it's called That Which Divides. And I actually sat down with Dayton last week, and we talked for a half hour or so about this novel that's coming out and about how he got into writing for Star Trek in the first place, you know, and how he approaches writing for the different time periods, because he also writes TNG era stuff in the Typhon Pack series. Mm-hmm. And that's going to come out actually by the time this Ready Room comes out. It'll already be on our site in Matterstream. So I just wanted to mention that that's coming up and encourage everybody to go over and check out that episode of Matterstream as well.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of waiting for it to come out myself. You've been telling me about this interview you had, but it's not like just because I'm part of Trek FM doesn't mean I get advanced copies, apparently. I think this is sort of leading to that tension between the two of us, Chris, that, you know, there's an episode like this that I really want to hear it, but no, I have to wait around like I'm just an ensign or something, and I have to wait like everyone else.
Yeah, well, all right. Sorry about that. I'll send my stunt double back over so you can punch him again.
Thank you.
All right, so that's going to be, coming out by the time this show is out. And looking forward to reading the novel as soon as I can get my hands on it.
Very good.
As well. Okay, Greg, so it's the 25th anniversary of the debut of Star Trek The Next Generation. So what kind of news do we have on this front today?
Yes, actually, I saw this and I was very quite excited that they're releasing some, basically, it's a memorabilia, it's plaques and pictures, that sort of thing. It's Mountain Memories, who mostly do sports memorabilia, is my understanding.
Yeah, it seems mostly sports stuff if you go to their site, yeah.
But these are some very cool things they've released. Basically, it's for your wall. It's a nicely framed cast photos or a picture of the Enterprise D. That's the one I especially like because it actually has the Enterprise D plaque that's on the bridge. And, you know, when it was commissioned and has the registry and all of that. That's actually, I'm looking to get those. And they're actually not that expensive. You can get things for as cheap as $20 or as much as $150. Just basically, if you're a big fan of TNG, this is a good way to commemorate the anniversary for yourself.
Yeah, if you have some wall space.
Right.
For sure. the one that's $150, it's actually $149.99, so it's less than $150. That's the limited edition version, and that one is going to be limited to 2012 units, and comes with a certificate of authenticity, and that one looks pretty cool. The other ones are a bit smaller. Like you said, you have the one of just the Enterprise. There are a couple of different ones with crew group photos. There's you've got Picard and, you know, each cast member separately, although Pulaski's not on there, so I'm not going to be buying that one.
Wesley's missing too. It's like Wesley and Pulaski don't even exist.
Yeah, they're just not even there. And I think I'm going to go for this other one here, the one that has, it's kind of cool. They're using the holographic technology. So if you tilt, like, it's going to be mounted on your wall. So you're not going to actually tilt it. But if you walk across the room and you watch it as you're walking the whole time, Geordi does a barrel roll.
That's great, Chris. I was getting all excited. I really wanted to purchase this lithograph you're talking about.
Yeah, well, keep your eyes open for that one.
Yes, I'm sure it's coming soon from Mountain Memories near you.
Yes. But these are available, you know, they have them on the StarTrek.com store. And when I looked there, they had shipping dates. They had kind of delays, like if you could pre-order maybe the limited edition, and if you got the other ones, it was like shipping 3 to 5 days or something. Mm-hmm. But on the Mounted Memories site, they were all like available now. And I don't know if there's a difference there, or if Mounted Memories site is one of those that just tells you that everything's available, and then when you order, you find out that it's going to take 3 days. I don't know. So, but there are two routes anyway for purchasing them, I believe. So, you can go there. You can. We actually have a piece about this on the Trek FM site. So, if you want the details about the sizes and the prices, and the link over to the StarTrek.com store to order, you can find that if you just go to trek.fm/news, and you'll find it there in the feed.
Yeah, which one do you think will you be getting, Chris?
Oh, well, besides
if you
the Geordi
had any
one,
wall space,
I actually like the one that's the, I think it's the sixth season cast photo.
Oh, okay,
It's the easiest way for me to differentiate which season the cast photos are from is by looking at Troy's hair, because that's the thing that's the most different usually about each cast season.
I think I was going to say Worf's makeup, but Troy's hair is up there as well.
Well, between the earlier seasons and the later seasons, yeah, Worf's makeup evolves quite a lot. In the later seasons, it's a bit more consistent.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But I've always liked the sixth season cast photo that you often see places. So possibly that one.
Cool, very nice. Yeah, I'm hoping to get the, I mean, it's $50, but it's a nice plaque showing the Enterprise D, you know, from below, so it looks its nicest and has that registry plaque. So I'm hoping to be able to pick up that in the coming weeks.
That would be cool. All right. So, well, on the merchandise front, Greg, I think we have something else of interest here.
Yes, because we've been talking for weeks now about these busts that are basically coming from Titan merchandise. A few more have been announced. Now, we've talked before about the Kirk and the Picard. I believe we talked about the Spock and the McCoy before, haven't we?
Yeah, are these the same busts that we talked about before, though, or are these different ones?
We did. We did at least talk about the Kirk and Picard of
this
like,
set.
It may have been months ago, because it shows Kirk all in action with a gun. I believe these are ones we've talked about.
Okay.
But
I think the Spock one we talked
detailed about
may have been from some other series, though.
Okay, that's possible. Yeah. But they're very detailed and they're very realistic. I feel like they either did scans of the actors, which that would be hard at this point because the actors have aged. So they must have just had a really good sculptor go in there and make it, because they're very impressive looking. It's not like a lot of times when you see action figures, that sort of thing, and it kind of looks like the actor, but not really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sometimes they're off. They're creepy sometimes, actually.
Yeah.
Especially like the lips, you know, the lips will like really creep you out, mm-hmm. where you like you can't look at it. But yeah, these are very, very realistic and very nicely done. The only problem I have with these, Greg, now tell me if this is the case for you, is that if I had these sitting on my desk, it's kind of hard for me to look past the fact that the base, it looks like a platypus that's had its feet welded together, fused together somehow. It's kind of creepy. I think they're going to like hop off my desk, kind of like a pogo stick.
I like that. I get what you're saying, but I like that each one has the Starfleet insignia from the era, and it even has the correct one. So it has a like the original series science one, or it has the TNG one. So I like that it's down there, but it is maybe a weird looking base. It'd be interesting to see what it looks like in person. Hopefully, it's a little a little less odd. You might have to like put a shrubbery in front of it when it sits on your desk.
Bring me a shrubbery.
And crazily enough, so basically here we have Kirk and Picard and Spock and McCoy and also Data and Khan. And crazily enough, this Khan, still the chest piece, that's Ricardo Montalban. That's not fake.
Yes.
It's just Ricardo Montalban.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
Yes, it is. Oh, I do think I would have rather have seen the McCoy instead of holding up. He's holding up a red, I guess, was it like a blood sample or I don't know. What is that? A hypo spray? Is that like a red alert? Is that an alarm siren on that thing? What is that?
It's an odd thing he's holding. I think it is a hypo spray of some sort, but it looks like he might be auditioning for American Idol or something.
Oh gosh. I was going to say I would have rather seen that be green. I like the way that he can mix elixirs. You know, like he has no scientific equipment around. He'll just like mix some liquids together, make some green concoction, kind of eyeball it, and then tell everybody to drink it and you're going to be better. I'd personally be really nervous about that.
This
looks
magic
like
touch.
It should work. Here, why don't you chug this?
At least on the original series, it didn't hurt when you got hyposprayed. It appears that in the reboot, the alternate universe, it actually hurts when you get hyposprayed. So at least
that's
when
McCoy
jabbed you,
like,
it was okay.
Jabs you with it. Here, hold still, whack. He has the bedside manner of the doctor on Voyager.
Yes, exactly.
Early Voyager.
Or when Crusher was helping Q with his back pain in Deja Q. Sort of push that hyper spray in there and really make it. There you go.
Well, according to Dork Trek, Crusher, she's kind of sadistic, right?
At least she
kills everybody, I believe, right?
I believe they invented some dialogue for the show where Q asked Crusher if any of her patients have survived. I don't think Q actually said that in the show, but they all wanted that dialogue to exist so much that they just believed it and made it happen.
You'd better go check the Memory Alpha page for Deja Q and be sure that hasn't been added.
Well, Memory Beta, apparently. They're going in and putting their own Memory Beta things in.
Yeah, they did spend time on the show talking about their plans to conquer Memory Beta, I believe, right?
Yes.
Make it their own. So, all right. Well, these busts. Now, are you going to get one of these busts to go along with your Enterprise-D plaque?
You know, I'd like to. I'm not sure which one I'd get, though. Probably the Picard, but I'm not sure where I would put it at this point. Maybe when I graduate to my new apartment that's more permanent, I'll start collecting these, but they're a little expensive. They're actually $80 a piece, I believe.
Yeah, they are $80 a piece. Well, you can get the Picard one. He's got his finger out, you know, pointing like engage. You could just tilt him to point at your door.
There you go.
Indicate the exit. Someone comes over you don't want to have there anymore. Just tell them, talk to the Picard. Head on out. So,
right.
So yeah, $80 bucks a piece. They're 8 inches tall and 5 inches wide. So apparently it's TV series Kirk. It's not movie Kirk. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they would be 7 inches wide, and they're coming from Titan merchandise. So, as part of the Star Trek Masterpiece Collection, and available in July.
Yeah. Available in July. I'm hoping they're going to announce a Riker, actually. Bearded Riker. Hopefully in the coming weeks. Because that's the one I would actually really be excited for.
I think the Bearded Riker one is going to be coming from Chia. They're doing like the Chia head. Where you actually grow Riker's beard. When you buy it, it's first season. And then 3 months later, the beard grows out. Just like the third season of...
Perfect.
I guess he actually grew he had the beard in the second season, didn't he? But
yeah.
But it's the third season when the show really matured, and so we say growing the beard for the third season.
Right. Yeah, I think people just try to forget the second season entirely and just assume that the beard came in the third season.
All right, Greg. Well, we have one girl on film and a couple of guys as yes. new pictures from the set of Star Trek 2013 have been leaked out as we move into movie news and rumors here.
Yes. Now, you can tell it's actual news and rumors because we were iMessaging each other manically. Have you seen the pictures? Can you believe what they said? We were very excited.
Although yes. Finally, it was something that was actually related to the filming of the movie, not right. helping animals across the road or things yes. like that. So,
yeah, Chris Pine punching someone else. I mean, at this point, that's not news.
Oh, but these photos have come out. They were posted, as I understand it, originally by MTV, although now they've been posted by, I think, just about everybody, even sites that have nothing to do with Star Trek, it seems.
Yes.
But they're out, and we've seen some scenes, what some people speculate might be the climax of the movie. We don't know that, but it's Spock and Uhura and Cumberbatch, whoever he's playing, engaged in some kind of battle. Now, MTV, they explained what was going on, right?
Right.
And just from these photos, they seem to really have the whole plot worked out.
Yeah, they definitely do, and they even mention that Spock uses his Vulcan death grip on yes. Cumberbatch, which I'm not sure if they realize that the death grip doesn't exist and it was made up by Spock in one of the episodes of the show.
Right. I like the message that you sent me, Greg, which was that MTV says, Spock uses Vulcan death grip. We haven't actually seen Star Trek. It's like Lord of the Rings, right?
And one of the sites called him Cumberpatch. Which
yes.
led to some pretty good, I believe it is Star Trek 2 Cumberpatchin.
Yes, Cumberpatchin. It's either that one or the other possibility. Now, I have not confirmed this with sources, but I am speculating here, and it's a very real possibility that time travel may be involved in this next movie. It's Star Trek Cumberpatch Kids. And... they're going to time travel back to 1984. They have to get some Cumberpatch kids, which are they're kind of like Cabbage Patch Kids, except right. they were like a popular Chinese knockoff. But the Cumberpatch probe is coming back to find out why there are no Cumberpatch kids in the 23rd century.
Wow. This may be the craziest whale probe that we've ever come up with, the Cumberpatch Kid Probe. But I do think it's a distinct possibility. Now I'm assuming
possibly.
That most of our listeners have seen these pictures by now. Then they know what's in the pictures. But maybe we can just talk about it a little bit and come up with our own speculation for what it is. Now, I think we can probably knock a few things off the rumor mill at this point. Cumberbatch is probably not playing an alien. He appears to be human in these pictures. Would you agree with that, Chris?
Yes, it's he definitely looks human in the photos. Of course, there are a lot of alien races in Star Trek that look essentially human. The photos, I mean, it's not like we're getting, you know, 8-megapixel gigantic photos that we can zoom in on the details on here. We're getting, you know, fairly small photos.
Very true.
You know, so we don't know for sure if there's, you know, like something unusual about his face or all, but it doesn't appear to be the case in the photos. He does look like he's human. And he does, you have to look really, really closely, but it does appear that he is wearing some sort of Starfleet issued clothing or
yes.
some sort of Starfleet uniform.
Which a lot of people have said this means he's playing Gary Mitchell, or at least he's some sort of Starfleet cadet. I think this helps my theory that he's actually playing Q, because what does Q like to do best but put on a Starfleet uniform and torment the crew?
That is true. That is true. So it could be Q. Definitely could be Q. It's not Gary Mitchell. I'm sure it's not Gary Mitchell. I don't know. So many people, I still hear them saying that, yes, okay, it's definitely Gary Mitchell. Now, I will admit that Cumberbatch, his appearance works as Gary Mitchell, but they killed Gary Mitchell in the comics, and the comics are being overseen by Roberto Orci, who's writing the story for the movie, and he has said that they tie into the next movie. I don't see why they would kill off a character who is then going to be the villain in the movie. So
yeah.
I am sure it's not Gary Mitchell.
There's not much we can tell from the pictures themselves about who he's playing, I think. You know, he's probably not going to be Harry or Henry Mudd. I do think he's somebody from Starfleet, but that doesn't tell us that much. And we see that Spock appears to be doing a Vulcan nerve pinch on Cumberpatch. Cumberpatch?
Right.
Cumberpatch?
Cumberpatch.
But I believe it's MTV or Trek Movie or somebody was saying that he appears to be able to overcome it. And I don't see the evidence of that from the pictures itself. Yeah. It just looks like Spock's doing it to him.
Well, so MTV, they're the ones who were actually describing all of that on the page,
right,
originally, I believe. And that's why I said they seem to have a lot of plot points just based on a couple of photos.
Yeah.
They were saying that Zachary Quinto is using the Vulcan death grip on Benedict Cumberbatch's villain, but Cumberbatch is able to overcome it and regain the upper hand in the battle. And like, you got all of that from that photo.
Well, they they have the leaked line from the script, which is, I'm a Tordarian. Vulcan death grips don't work on me. Only money.
And you know JJ is really pissed that that got out.
I know. I mean, we knew he was a fan of Star Wars, but we didn't know he was going to be actually lifting lines and putting them in his film. And now he's furious that that got out.
Well, it explains, you know, why he was seen having dinner in various restaurants with George Lucas over the past 6 months. So it all makes sense now. It's all coming full circle. But talking about the plot line there, mm-hmm, I think then Trek Movie said something about that there was, I forget if they said it was leaked. I mean, I guess it would have to be leaked at this point, but something, it was like set notes about, you know, what was being shot about that. So maybe it all was also leaked that like, this is what's actually going on in this scene. That may have been leaked. And MTV kind of just, it sounded like they were just speculating completely based on one photo. I don't know.
Right. I think we're still pretty sure that this isn't Cybok, right? I thought maybe Cybok would be able to overcome the nerve pinch, but still he doesn't have the eyebrows and the ears.
I don't think it's Cybok, no. There are a couple things. Now one, it could be George Kirk. We don't know. This coming week, IDW is going to release the second half of Operation Annihilate in comic form, and we're going to find out what happens if George Kirk dies or if he goes back to the Enterprise. We don't know yet. At the end of the first part of that, it was just James T. Kirk and George Kirk facing each other, mm-hmm, and he's saying like, oh, hello, brother, or something. And so it could be that. I mean, if you think about it, they take George Kirk back to the Enterprise, and maybe he joins Starfleet. Maybe he's just on the ship. Maybe they issue... If you remember in Tomorrow is Yesterday, they brought Captain Christopher from the past and they still gave him a normal Starfleet uniform to wear around the ship. So you don't know, you know, just because Cumberbatch in this photo is wearing what appears to be a Starfleet uniform doesn't mean he's a member of Starfleet. All it means is that, I mean, he could have stolen it out of somebody's drawers for all we know. Who knows?
Yeah, it doesn't tell us that much, but it is interesting that he's at least wearing it. It does make us think maybe he won't be Khan or Klingon and go down that route. Yeah.
Now, a couple of interesting things that I saw speculated on by some fans in some discussion threads is that he could be playing Finnegan from Shore Leave, mm-hmm, who was, you know, kind of a upperclassman who used to bully Kirk all the time in the Academy. I don't know about that. I think that's very doubtful. But a very interesting one is some people have suggested that he's Captain Garth from Whom Gods Destroy.
Right. Right. And as I was saying with the lifting from Star Wars, I was looking over Captain Garth and he appears to be the Count Dooku of Star Trek.
Yeah, right.
He was a high placed Starfleet official, but he sort of left Starfleet to chart his own course.
Right. Yeah. But that one, that's a pretty good speculation there. Mm-hmm. Now, I will say that I still think it's going to be a new character. Well, I should back up. I had previously said that I thought it would be Kor Koloth.
Right.
But now, seeing these photos, it's clearly not a Klingon, so that's not going to happen. If we're looking at the fact that he has on a Starfleet uniform or clothing, I still think it's more likely to be a new character as opposed to somebody lifted out of one of the original episodes. But if it is someone from an original episode, I think the Captain Garth scenario does make quite a bit of sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. It's an interesting character to go down. If they're going to do something like that, I'd prefer it was a sequel to an episode that wasn't Khan, you know.
Yeah.
Do something maybe a little less known, chart their own course with it. But no, I'm really hoping for a new character and really give Cumberbatch the ability to sink his teeth into something brand new and not have to reinvent something. And, you know, we heard, I think it was Pine talking about Cumberbatch's intensity. And I think yes. You can really see that in these pictures. You know, the intense look on his face is really, really quite striking.
He's very intense in these photos.
Yeah.
I was actually frightened that he was going to attack me. Through the photo, he's so intense.
Right. Now, let's see. Quinto and Cumberbatch aren't the only people that had set pictures taken of them.
Right. And this leads me to my other speculation of what the storyline is.
Okay.
What's actually happening here? To me, anyway, it's really clear from the photos that have been leaked that what happened was that Cumberbatch's character, he walked in on Spock and Uhura, you know, kind of having a little off-duty activity, if you know what I mean. And they were really upset about it. They were concerned that Kirk was going to reprimand them, even though at the end of the Galileo 7 comic, Kirk orders them to shared confinement in Spock's quarters. and they are now attacking Cumberbatch's character. You know, Spock was going to try to use his death grip, as it's known, in music television circles. And when it didn't work, Uhura had to resort to a phaser.
Nice. Now, can we tell from the picture, is Uhura using the stun or the kill setting?
It's hard to tell from the photo. I think that these new phasers in the next movie may have an additional setting that we don't know about yet.
Ooh, interesting.
As Dennis Miller said many years ago on his Off-White album, the phasers may be set to melancholy.
Nice. Well, I think about the only thing we can be sure of in these pictures is that Zoe Saldana is still extremely hot.
Yes, that's the one thing I know is that she still looks fantastic in this red skirt uniform.
Yes.
So,
but other than that,
we've learned. Well, actually, we didn't learn that. We already knew that, and we've confirmed that it remains true for the next movie.
Right. Yes. Trek FM exclusive. Zoe Saldana still hot.
Yes.
But she is using a phaser. I don't remember her using a phaser in the first film, so that's gives her a little bit more action. That's pretty good.
Well, she wanted an action scene, from what I understand. So maybe they are giving her something more to do. I mean, it is nice to see that maybe she has something more to do than just run up and hug Spock every time the ship shakes. Though, I do wonder in the situation as well. Now, we know in the Galileo 7 comic, she steals a shuttlecraft. Spoiler alert, if you haven't read this, but it came out quite a few months ago, and rescues Spock from the creatures on the surface. Now she's rescuing Spock from Cumberbatch's villain. Mm-hmm. Is Uhura going to become the person who just rescues Spock all the time in the alternate timeline?
Well, it's like that relationship Data and Worf have in Next Generation, where Worf tries and then Data just does it. So in this one, in the new universe, Spock's going to try to do something and completely fail, and Uhura's going to have to swoop in and do it for him. It's a good dynamic, I think.
Well, we have one other bit of news. Well, before I get to that, related to this, MTV did an interview with Zoe Saldana after they leaked the photos, and she reports that JJ was very upset. She says, "I have to say that it's not going to stop people from intruding, but they are, and it's such a bummer because it only hurts them by stealing away the surprise."
I don't know. I have a hard time believing that these pictures were not official. Like, you don't just let people on the set with a camera and then not realize those pictures are going to make it out there.
Yeah. I mean, the quality of the images is really poor. So it could be someone shooting them with a cell phone camera. or something.
I guess that's possible.
Not an actual camera. As we were talking about in the other side of the room, I do believe that JJ is upset as the creative head of the project that these scenes, you know, what's happening in the film, are getting out. Mm-hmm. The studio, however, if they really, really had a problem with it, I don't think that MTV would still have the photos on their website.
Exactly, yeah.
So I don't think the studio particularly minds that these images are getting out, because look at how much conversation it's generated. I even heard that Star Trek II was trending on Twitter over the past couple of days because of this. So
it's great publicity. I think people at Paramount might have been listening to our show and realizing that there wasn't all that much news, and they decided they needed to inject a little bit of extra actual interesting stuff into the system to give it a jolt.
They're like, we got to leak some photos so Chris and Greg will stop making up stories about chili dinners and things like that. Oh, you know, it's interesting though what she says here, that the only reason that I'm actually following things like photos from the set of the movie or news about the storyline or who the villain might be is because I'm doing this Star Trek podcast and I'm publishing this Star Trek website, because just as a fan personally, I would rather go into the movie without knowing anything at all.
Yeah, definitely.
About what's going on. I remember going back to when Generations came out and First Contact and Insurrection, that I made it a point actually to stay away from news. I did not want to know what was going on. And it was great going into those movies, having no idea what I was going to see. And First Contact in particular, I was, my colleague, back then I used to run a drum scanner in pre-press, and I had a colleague who was a big Star Trek fan, and we worked at this tiny little room together all day long in the dark with these computer displays because we're doing photo color correction. And so we're talking about Star Trek all the time. He wanted to know everything that was going on about the movie, and I didn't want to know anything. So it was really tough. This was back in Alabama, and one of the gas stations was doing a promotion tied into the release of First Contact, and they were putting these big posters of the Enterprise E on all the gas pumps. Oh God, I almost had to change gas stations because, like, I don't want to see what the new ship looks like. I want to see it on the screen.
Yeah.
So I would rather go in not knowing, personally.
Yeah, I'd love to, but obviously because we're doing this show, and, you know, honestly, I'd end up looking at these things anyway. I held off from watching.
No self-control, Greg.
Exactly. I really don't.
That's why you keep punching my stunt double all the time.
There's so much evidence that I have no self-control. But, you know, I held off on looking at these pictures as long as possible, but, you know, I had to, you know. It's just, I love Star Trek so much, and there's not enough Star Trek news every week that's like news that I have to look at these spoiler images. Now, if stuff starts coming out about the plot, like actual like things that are actually going to spoil the experience, I'm going to try to avoid it as much as possible. But it's going to be hard because we're doing this show to avoid knowing quite a bit about the film before we go.
Yeah, well, we have to. I fully suspect that sometime within the next couple of months that a copy of the script is going to be leaked onto the internet. If I were the studio, I would leak a fake copy of the script with a different plot than the real movie just to get it out of the way. But
right. Well, I was saying on the other side of the room, it's entirely possible that these pictures are fake. I mean, maybe they're trying to throw everyone off course and Cumberbatch still is playing Kor/Koloth/Kang.
Could be. Or he could be one of the original series Klingons who had the genetic mutation, so he doesn't have the forehead ridges, but he has an extreme case, you know, like Michael Jackson's skin whitening thing, where he's becoming so human looking that you cannot tell that he has any Klingon in him at all anymore.
Well, wasn't that the story? Well, at least in, I think it was the Trials and Tribulations, that someone was masquerading as human when they were in fact a Klingon. So, well, it's entirely possible for you to do that.
Yeah. That's Arn Darvin, but it was never clear to me really if he, and certainly going back to the trouble with Tribbles before the whole debate about what Klingons look like came out in the first place, I always kind of thought he was like a genetically altered to, or not genetically altered, but even like just cosmetically altered to really, really look human, to be a secret agent, as Tom Paris would say.
All you have to really do is just shave the silly mustache and, you know, clean the chimney sweep makeup off, and
and
then you just look human,
and get out of the Klingon threads and put on a Starfleet uniform. And
if you put on a nice suit, it's suddenly hard to not look like a human.
Right. Okay. Well, one more thing in movie news here, Greg. There's now some speculation that Scotty may be getting a new uniform. Now, did you see this photo and video?
Yes, this is something that's so ridiculous. It's a video, right, that Simon Pegg did with Carl Urban from the set, but they're sort of wearing cloaks or something to cover their uniforms.
Yeah. They're wearing jackets. I think they said they were bad robot issued jackets, you know, to wear around the movie set. Although if the purpose of the jacket is to truly conceal your costume, Carl Urban is like really falling down on the job because he's got it unzipped. You can see like the whole blue of his uniform, whereas Simon Pegg's got it zipped all the way up. I don't know. You know, maybe it was cold at night that night, chilly. They're wearing jackets. I have no idea. It's hard to tell, you know, Pegg. He may not even be in costume at all. Mm-hmm. It does look like he may be wearing the green cadet. Not green, the gray cadet uniform that we saw them wearing in the first movie. You know, that's
possible.
A color. It could be that. Who knows?
So many things. I mean, I've watched the video. I can't really tell from the video anything about Scotty's costume. So I think people are over speculating just a bit.
Yeah. The only thing I can tell is that obviously Simon Pegg has some sort of severe pollen allergy, and his he seems to be having itchy, watery eyes.
I thought that Chris Pine had just given him a once-over earlier that day.
I told you to stop saying it's exciting around here.
This new uniform is exciting.
Oh, but yeah, there's been speculation that his eye in the video, it's, you know, makeup, he's been in a fight, which, yeah, that's completely plausible.
Sure.
Could be the case.
As I told you, Chris, welcome to the next year of our lives.
I know.
Where every little detail that comes out about the film is overanalyzed, overthought.
Yes. What I can't tell from the photos is... I can't tell if Uhura's boots are made by the same manufacturer or if they got a different boot designer for this movie. I'm waiting for more leaked photos of Zoe Saldana. Not that I have, you know, any kind of search set up on Google, you know, to automatically send me photos of Zoe Saldana or anything like that. But, you know, some more may come out soon.
Well, not to confirm or deny that I have high-level inside sources taking set photos of the new Star Trek film, but I'll have them get some pictures of the boots for you, Chris.
Thanks, Greg. In Voyager's third season, we got a classic Star Trek time travel tale in the form of Future's End, a two-parter. And today we're going to talk about Future's End. And joining us from the Delta Quadrant via some sort of bizarre temporal explosion from the 29th century are Charlene Schmidt and J.D. Onassi. Welcome to the Ready Room, guys.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, thanks.
You're welcome. It's like a crossover, like NBC likes to do.
Hey, you know, I gotta say, Matt's totally jealous, so that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. That's pretty awesome, huh?
Yeah,
Yeah.
Well, so, JD, I understand that you just got a Star Trek tattoo, and I was a little bit surprised because being that you are a host on the Delta Quadrant, I was really sure that you were going to go with the Junkyard Klingon tattoo, but it turns out you got something a little bit different.
Yeah, well, what I ended up with was the image of the comm badge that that Deep Space Nine and Voyager use. Because around my leg, I sort of had this chain of like small random images, and I've got about that big. I've got a TOS style Starfleet symbol with the command Starburst, and I've got a Klingon Empire tattoo. And initially, what I was gonna try to do was get those sort of increased and, you know, make them a lot bigger, but then I started thinking about it. I'm like, no, I want something that's big and like super nerdy. Mm-hmm. So I was like, yeah, Voyager DS9 comm badge. It's about the nerdiest I can get. So, and it's about that big and about wide. So,
Maybe you could have done like an overweight Wesley Crusher tattoo though. That would have been big and nerdy.
Oh, well, that's for life, man.
At some point I might get, you know, shut up Wesley tattoo. But...
well, I guess my question, JD, can you tap the comm badge and communicate with the ship?
No, unfortunately, I can't.
That was going to be my question, too.
But, you know, well, that's okay, because on the other side of my leg, at some point, probably going to get, from the Mirror Universe, you know, they had the Cardassian and Klingon.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Gauntlet. I think I might get that symbol on the other side.
That'd be pretty cool. Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about getting a mobile emitter here on the side of my arm.
I think tattoo. You totally should. you totally should.
I think that's pretty much the nerdiest possible Star Trek tattoo I could get. So
I think you might be right about that. Unless, of course, around your wrist, you got like the old wavy ring.
Ooh, that's pretty good.
From TOS.
That's pretty good too.
Just make sure you don't make yourself an ensign.
Yeah.
If you're gonna go for it, go big.
Or right here you could get the Commodore, Commodore symbol. Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah, nice. Right on your chest.
Nice. A couple pips along your neck.
Yeah, right on the neck, yeah. Four captain's pips.
Why don't you just go all out and get like a command uniform tattoo full body? And you know, actually, if you do like the uniforms from the motion picture, you can do the pants as well, and no one will think that it's unusual that there's that, you know, little lump there in the front.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Man. Everybody.
Yeah, you can get the whole tracksuit. You can get the whole tracksuit pajama outfit tattoo. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
All right. Well, turning attention to Futures End, I do have, Charlene, a question for you and Greg leading us into this episode. Now, I understand that you guys are going to explain to us about this project that you're working on together, writing some kind of Sarah Silverman slash fiction or something based on Futures End. Or
you know, I'm really surprised you mentioned this because it's not exactly family friendly. It's Sarah Silverman's character, Rainn Robinson. She and Janeway have kind of this alternate thing going on that was behind the scenes that nobody really talks about. Greg and I hash it out, and it's explicit, and it's beautiful, and it's totally raunchy at the same time.
It's hardcore.
You know, but it's a work of art.
It really is. I mean, the interaction
it's sort of like
between
the joke,
Rain
the
and
Aristocrats.
I so, am absolutely terrified.
Where it's just so horrible and raunchy, it's great. It's kind of like that, you know.
And this is going to be available soon on Kindle, I believe, right? But not on iBooks because I'm pretty sure it violates Apple's rules and regulations in terms of what you can put
in
the store.
And
pretty much every single one.
Hopefully we have some photo illustrations that go in the ebook as well. We're trying to negotiate that right now.
All right. Okay, so Futures End, Greg, what were your first thoughts when you went back now to watch Futures End once again?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting. So the Voyager's the show I've sort of seen the whole thing again most recently. I guess last January I was watching it. And my remembrance was always that this was an episode I didn't like, mainly because it reminds me of Star Trek IV. It's just another Let's go back in time to present day. Let's have a stupid little storyline. So every time I watch it, I'm impressed by how much I actually like it. Because the characters are interesting. What they're doing is actually... There's a cool plot going on and a villain. And that's one thing Star Trek IV, I think, was missing, was this powerful villain that Ed Begley Jr. plays.
So you're saying you wish that Star Trek IV had Ed Begley Jr. in it, and then you would have liked the movie.
That would have... If only David Livingston had directed Star Trek IV, I probably would have loved it.
All right. And Charlene, you told me in the other side of the room that you kind of don't really like this episode.
Well, I do, but I don't. What I don't like about it is how they kind of do the whole, how they get to 1996 Earth.
Mm.
The messy time travel 29th century deal. I feel like it's a hot mess. Mm-hmm. And
kind of like your story you're working on with Greg, right?
Hey now, at least I feel like that's more consistent than this.
Well, I mean, it breaks Dork Trek's number one rule, which is don't F with time.
Yes.
And here's Braxton showing up out of nowhere saying, you guys messed everything up and now I'm going to fix it by blowing you up. Yep. Like, that's
right.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, well, and then here's the other thing. Okay, it's the ship Braxton is on, the Aeon, is that what it is?
That's right.
It's from 500 years in the future. And think about this. If we were talking with ancestors from our perspective 500 years back to the 15, maybe early 1600s, would they understand a frickin' thing about our lives? And if we were just telling, if we were just kind of pushing them around and saying, just, you know, don't mind us, we'll take care of this, you just sit back and enjoy the ride. Never mind the fact that maybe we're trying to kill them. I kind of feel like it's the same thing. And the fact that Voyager tries to push back and even succeeds just a little bit kind of flusters me. Like, no way. No. That does not work. I'm sure 500 years of advancing technology, really, Voyager should have just had Jesus beaten out of it.
Yeah. Well,
in a heartbeat. Of course, that doesn't advance the plot. And so, you know.
Well, and the problem is that the technology from the 29th century is not advanced in the way that it should be.
Yeah.
It's more like 24th century technology that Braxton is using.
Well, he shoots some sort of weird beam at them, which we had photon torpedoes, quantum torpedoes. You should have some sort of super advanced torpedo, fire, you know, 1.5 of them at Voyager, and then it blows up. It doesn't seem like it should be that hard for the 29th century ship to blow up the Voyager.
And Voyager not only manages to hold it off for a while, but almost succeeds, and that just does not seem realistic to me at all.
No. Well, JD, how about you going into this episode? What are your thoughts
on it? I actually haven't seen this episode since the very first time it aired. I forgot that I had actually forgotten that Sarah Silverman was ever on Star Trek. she showed up, and I'm like, wow, this was like before Sarah Silverman was somebody, and it was after Ed Begley Jr. was anybody. So, they sort of brought the up and comer on along with the total has been, or possibly never was. I don't know. But I remember watching this episode then and thinking, this is just so, because they bring it back to like 1996, and I'm like, was life really like that then? But of course, I wasn't living in California. I was living in Georgia at the time, so I don't know. Maybe life was sort of like that. And then, like 2 years later, I moved to Thousand Oaks, California, which is about 45 minutes away from Los Angeles. And I went to Los Angeles, and I'm like, oh my God, it really is that screwed up. weird. But you know, watching the episode, and like, all right, they have to of course they have to cover up the Vulcan's ears like they did with Spock, but this time, because of course the actor's black, we have to give him a do-rag, right? And of course they have to dress him in really trendy clothes, and I'm like, I'm offended by this. quite honestly. But then I'm watching it with Paris in his Hawaiian shirt, and all he needed mm-hmm. was a mustache and a fro, because he needed the car. Like, they steal the truck, and I'm like, why didn't he steal a convertible? You know, totally go all out with the 20th century stereotypes. But
right. Well, you know, Paris is supposed to be so into cars in the 20th century and all. Would he steal a Dodge Ram truck? Don't
no,
you think he
right.
would steal
no. I,
it, well, a Mustang or some?
Well,
you know,
I look
something.
At it like he's the pilot of the ship, right? He'd want something cool and fast. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
The Dodge Ram just, that was definitely like, look, if Chakotay was going to steal it, he would have stolen the Dodge Ram.
He'd get a Ram.
Right.
You know, if PDA,
it's true,
a.k.a. poor dumb Harry, was going to steal it, he would have picked like a Geo Tracker or something. but Paris?
I was actually thinking a Ford Fiesta.
Yes, a Ford Fiesta. That would have been definitely PDH. But Paris? Yeah. A truck? No. I could have maybe seen, he would have gone for a Pontiac maybe or something.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
If he wanted to be reasonable about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
well, then here's the other issue. Nobody drives a truck around Los Angeles unless they have to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody drives a sporty cars with a convertible top. You go down. If nothing else, you've got a sunroof or a moonroof because it's 76 degrees every single freaking day there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got to say, my husband and I, we did spend a part of our honeymoon in Los Angeles. We were going up the coast of California, and I went to Venice Beach. And yes, it really is something like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I kind of did my own thing where I was standing on the boardwalk, and I could have worn my Starfleet uniform and no one would have noticed.
Yeah, did your great-great-great-grandmother skate by you?
No, I didn't run into her.
And like intentionally try to skate right between you and your husband as you walk down the boardwalk?
You know, I was waiting for her. I was gonna be more than happy to let her go through, and she just never came by. I don't get it.
It was funny when, you know, they get down there, they're in Los Angeles, they're wearing their civvies, and Tuvok points out, we could have worn the Starfleet uniforms
right.
and yeah, not looked out of place. Noticed. And yeah. I sat there thinking to myself, this was the cast's excuse to be on camera as themselves
mm-hmm.
and ditch the uniforms. And
right.
Because I noticed that when they got down to, like, Paris kept his hair the same. You know, Janeway changed her hair clip. And Robert
Janeway
Beltran
changed...
just combed his hair flat versus
flat.
having the comb back. So,
yeah.
You know what?
Janeway right. changed her hair for the rest of the series. Like, you notice she goes back to Voyager. She's got the hair still down, and she continues with that for as long as I can remember. Like, she just used this as an excuse to just redo everything.
Well, yeah, she does wear the ponytail for about a year
mm-hmm.
from this point forward, and then she chops it off for Year of Hell.
Right, that's true.
You know,
but then, speaking of the uniforms, here's an interesting point. Later on, in part two, Rainn Robinson, Sarah Silverman's character, she calls Doctor Mr. Leisure Suit.
Yes.
Kind of poking fun at the uniforms. Maybe they would have gotten a couple of odd looks. Maybe not.
I found it amusing that the Doctor, the one guy where you could change his uniform with a push of a button, he's the only one who wears a Voyager uniform in LA.
Yes.
You know, like, how easy would it have been for Ed Begley Jr. just to, like, click a couple things on the mobile emitter?
I don't think it ever occurred to him to change his uniform.
I think they missed a couple of opportunities here. Okay, they're wandering around Los Angeles. I'm really surprised that as they're walking, we never saw the Paramount Studios logo at all. Like,
that would have been great if they walked right by that. Yeah,
they didn't. They should have passed by the gates with the sign that said Paramount and then just sort of looked and said, oh, I wonder what the purpose of this place is.
Nice. They did. They were shooting on the Paramount lot. Like, apparently, if you know where to look, it's like the administrative buildings for Star Trek are like there in the background.
What would have really been cool is if they looked over there and they saw some people wearing Starfleet costumes shooting a TV show.
Yeah, yeah, no, like yeah, they could have, or you know, seen some people like Armin Shimmerman or just somebody walking around in civvies and saying, "Oh, he looks rather important," or something. Yeah, you know, they could have had some of their own commentary in there, but you know,
that would have been fun.
Watching the episode again, I'm like, I did enjoy the episode, but like Charlene said, it is horribly inconsistent. Like, there's times where it moves at breakneck speed, and then there's times where it's like, is this going somewhere? Did they did they lose the script and they're just winging it? You know, my daughter was watching a little bit of it with me, and like the very first time, like they're trying to escape the university. And the guy comes out with the phaser, and he's trying to, you know, he's trying to stop him from leaving. And she said, is he from the same time that they are? And I'm like, no, he's from the 29th century. And she said, is this what's really going to happen in the future? I'm like, no, it's just a TV show. And she's like, when's the 29th century? Like about 800 years from now. She's like, yes. Oh, I don't think any of us will be there. I'm like, I'm not really sure that we're going to have to worry about it.
Yeah. It is interesting watching Star Trek with little kids.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause she watches it with me sometimes anyways. Like she's seen some of the movies. I mean, she's 7. It can only keep her attention for so long, but it's like she was watching this and she's like, well, how come they're wearing normal clothes? And I was like, because they traveled back in time. They're like, well, how? And I'm like, you know, sort of hard to explain. And then I sat there thinking to myself, you know, it's sort of a plot hole. So,
yeah. Well, let's talk about that for a minute now, how they got back in time. Because I want to talk about time travel and the temporal prime directive.
Right
here, because time travel, of course, in Star Trek, you have all sorts of different ways that something can go wrong, or you can slingshot around the sun or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
To travel through time. And of course you have the prime directive, and the prime directive is what basically that we cannot interfere in the development of another society unless they have warp capability, and then we can screw with them all we want,
right?
Especially if it's beneficial to us. But so this Captain Braxton comes back, and now, he doesn't quote the temporal prime directive in the beginning, but at the end of the episode, when Janeway asks, can you return us to our century, but leave us here? And he's like, sorry, temporal prime directive. So then I think back to the beginning, I'm like, okay, so you have a temporal prime directive, and in this prime directive, you are a Federation ship that comes back in time to destroy another Federation ship.
Completely.
With no warning.
Right.
To erase them from time. What are all the things that Voyager was supposed to do over those years that now don't happen? It did not make any sense.
Well, and if you go back to
a prime directive,
just go back to the teaser where Braxton crashes, in California. Why didn't a temporal agent appear then in 1967 and just like put him back where he belongs? Like, we could have avoided this whole thing if, you know, if they're actually monitoring the timeline, like with sensors, then this whole episode should never have happened, because they should have fixed it the moment it started happening.
Well,
exactly. So by doing this whole thing with the temporal prime directive and future time cops, if you will, it opens the door to so many problems that I kind of take Janeway's stance on it. It gives me a headache and I just don't want to deal with it.
Well, who was the guy on Enterprise? What's his name? The guy from the 28th century that came around for Shockwave.
Yeah, Crewman Daniels.
Yeah, Daniels. Where was he? Where was he for this? The ship crashes in 1967. Crewman Daniels should have been sitting there taking notes saying, boy, Archer never had to deal with this. yeah, there was a vast inconsistency, because really, well, or the two guys, not Mulder and Scully. Oh, Scully and, what'd they call them? The two guys from trials and tribulations. They
right.
Yeah,
they're anagrams of Mulder and Scully.
Yeah, they're anagrams. Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody that does their job really should have shown up there, or at least been monitoring from afar what Ed Begley Jr. was doing. But it's almost like nobody noticed until much, much, much later when Ed Begley Jr. was already insane.
Right.
And then
and it's like Braxton. Braxton almost comes across as like a rogue future time cop.
Yeah,
he doesn't feel like he's working with everyone else. He shows up out of nowhere, tries to blow up the ship. He crashes, loses the ship, and then sort of lives as a homeless guy for 30 years. Like, really, this is somebody from the 29th century, and these are his actions. Like, I feel like he should have been a little smart. And he disappears, doesn't he? Like, he never...
Well, he does disappear, like, early in the second part, and you never see him again. He
never see him again. Like, he
runs away
from
the cops.
Being a character.
And, yeah, well, he's gone.
You know, if he's going to pick a persona, you know, he's going to be like, well, I have to make my way here in 1996. Was a crazy, ranting, lunatic, homeless guy.
Yeah.
Was that really the best course of action? I mean, okay, you want to pretend to be homeless, fine. But really, you know, when the two police officers show up and he's like, but they're from the future. Like, they were well acquainted with this guy. I mean, they're like, oh, you again. You know, people are complaining you're putting up signs. And it's sort of like, maybe he should have tried to find a life where he was flying under the radar a little bit. Like, the cops should not be that accustomed to just showing up to talk to him.
Well. Or he could have used the technology from his time ship and started the whole computer revolution himself.
Indeed. Oh, yeah. Yeah. He totally could have made Steve Jobs and Bill Gates look small in the ocean of technolot. But no, he instead decides to look like Forrest Gump after he ran across the States for 7 years.
Well, you remember in First Contact when Picard's going to blow up the ship. And he sends everyone off in escape pods. And he tells them, you know, go find a quiet corner of Los Angeles and act like a raving lunatic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah.
That's right. That's what they were all supposed to do. Right. Yes.
Whole roving band of raving lunatics.
There's like a whole section of the city that's just full of raving lunatics who all claim they're from the future.
Oh, wait.
Don't you think if you're working...
Wait, we're talking about Los Angeles. There's lots of pockets of raving lunatics in Los Angeles. And they're not all talking about space travel.
You'd think if you work for the time cops, they have a whole class on what to do if you get stuck. Like, okay, if you get stuck in the 1800s, here's what to do. If you get stuck in 1967, here's what to do. Like, he shouldn't be caught off guard. You think this sort of thing happens all the time when you're messing with time like
this. They should have a list of standard operating procedures. Mm-hmm. When you get stranded, you don't have to necessarily do these things, but here's some guidelines. I'm pretty sure that whatever his criteria was to live by, what he did flew in the face of that. There's no way that this was a plan that anybody that he works with would have looked at and said, oh, this is flawless. Go with it. No.
Yeah, Starfleet Academy instructor saying, now, if you ever find yourself stranded in the 1990s, pretend to be a homeless person.
Right.
Attract as much attention from local law enforcement as possible.
That's right.
Right.
Make sure everybody in the city thinks that you're the biggest wacko in town.
Right, yeah, make sure a lot of people know you, too.
Yeah.
Even this episode itself acknowledges that, because B'Elanna and Chakotay talk about it. She asks him, what if we're stuck here? What are we going to do? And they talk about, well, we're going to have to be off the grid. We're going to have to lay low. Mm-hmm. And then Chakotay makes some jokes about being like a Nobel Prize winner or something like that.
Yeah, he's going to be an archaeology professor.
She says so much for being low-key. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Chakotay's thinking,
like, again,
oh, great,
it's
now I'm going to have
this...
to... Chakotay's thinking, I'm going to have to get an apartment with Janeway again, and I'm going to have to take care of her again. We're going to have to be together again. How many times do we have to get stuck somewhere, and I have to sleep with Janeway?
How many back rubs does he have to give before she finally just... You know?
Why does she always make me call her captain even when we're off duty? Oh.
Well, oh, all right, here's the question. What if the whole crew had gotten stranded there? What would poor dumb Harry have done? That's what I'm curious about. Like, where would he have found himself?
Drive through a Del Taco. Okay,
yeah, but wait, no. That would have presented no opportunities for him to get killed.
Oh, sure, he would have burned.
I don't know. You could have like a grease fire.
And then, slipped on like wet mop floor. And then, or, you know,
someone could rob the store late at night. Their 24-hour store.
Oh, yeah. Convenience store. No. See.
He would have been shot in an armed robbery.
There you go.
On the first day. Working graveyards.
They would have had to, like, just kill Neelix. They would have been like, oh, there's nothing we can do to help you.
No, he would have been like a chef at Olive Garden for a day.
Yeah.
They would have fired him.
Would you like more breadsticks with this? They're my special yellow root breadsticks.
Never.
He would have been a big star on the Food Network.
Like cinnamon with the garlic powder on the breadsticks.
Think of it, guys. Never-ending Leola root pasta.
Oh,
ooh,
gosh.
Yum.
Yum.
Love it.
Well, listen, while we're bringing up Harry, I did want to point out that what was Janeway thinking?
Putting him
Harry
in charge
of the ship.
Dude, anybody but him. Put Ensign Wildman in the chair.
Ensign Wildman. Or Naomi.
Harry. I guess he's the
Naomi
last
Wildman, you have the bridge.
Well, yeah, I would have put Naomi in charge.
Well, that's like every time.
She would have been more competent.
Like every time everybody from the Enterprise D crew had something better to do, so they put Troy in charge. Like,
right.
Or even Dr. Crusher.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what?
I mean, yeah.
I
understand when B'Elanna's like in engineering and she's like fixing the ship, like maybe leave Harry in charge. But when B'Elanna's on the bridge, why is she sitting there taking orders from Harry? Like,
you know, just I was sitting in the chair,
she outranks him.
Yeah.
I was wondering that too. I'm like, why is she following his? It, they even acknowledge that in the episode. You know, he's like, well, what should we do? And she's like, well, it's your call. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, no, don't leave it up to PDH. Do not leave it up to PDH. It's like, where's Carrie? He's in engineering. Go get him.
Go get Naomi. She'll see us through this.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, no, not.
But what about the other ensign that's working the communications over there who wants to know if they should respond to the signal from Earth?
Oh, God.
Yeah, good idea. Yeah. Starfleet Academy again. If you ever find yourself in the past and Earthlings of the 20th century broadcast a SETI greeting to you, respond and say hi.
Right.
Yeah, we're from the future.
Like
we needed Captain Sulu to say,
how's it going?
You know, are you kidding?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, that would be great.
And then, well, it was funny because, you know, you watch Paris and Tuvok, and they break into the dorm room, which, by the way, her security sucked. They just walked right in.
Seriously.
And then she's like, oh, didn't you see the sign that said keep out? And I'm like, dude, lock the door. Lock the door next time.
Right.
But it's like they walk
I guess there's no one back there usually.
No, apparently not.
It's a pretty obvious lack of protocol on her fault. And who hires this young kid to be a scientist for SETI anyway?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, here's the thing. All right, they get into building, which technically they really should have had badges to be able to get in there, right? But they get in there. It didn't take anything for them to hack into her computer, you know, to start reading the radio signals. And then, like, she's sitting at the computer. Paris is telling her what to modify, you know, on the, to get her readings better. And Tuvok casually pulls out the tricorder, and I'm like, dude, you're an inch away. She's going to see that. And yet, she's just sitting there so intently. I'm like, this is some pretty...
Well, she was under Paris's spell.
Right. Yeah, this is what I learned. If you're ever in the presence of Sarah Silverman, just throw some random basic technobabble at her, and she'll just be completely entranced and just not know what to do with herself.
Apparently.
Yeah,
you're the smartest person I've ever met.
Yeah.
And, well, I'll tell you what. This is definitely the cleanest performance that Sarah Silverman's ever given.
Well, I did text to Greg and I said, yeah, this is back when Sarah Silverman was actually somewhat attractive before she became obnoxious.
Because yeah,
I have never been a fan of Sarah Silverman
was,
in the later
acceptable.
Years. Yeah.
Right.
No. Never have found her funny.
Yeah,
I mean,
me
this
neither.
Was after she was fired from SNL.
She was.
Yeah, I've never liked.
She was already doing. Yeah.
I've never liked her comedy at all. And this is the only thing that I watch with her in it that I find tolerable.
Mm.
To be quite honest.
I think I like that she got a Star Trek script. And even though she wasn't a Star Trek fan, she said, no, that sounds like a good idea. I ought to do that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is.
Because not every comedian that's not already a fan would say that's a good career choice.
I really like when Star Trek brings in non-sci-fi actors to play these roles and when they play these bit parts. I mean, I always think that's kind of cool, but
yeah,
it's like she finished Voyager and waited a year, and then she just went off the deep end. She just ran in completely the opposite direction and just decided, you know what? I was on Star Trek. Now I'm free to offend everybody who can hear.
Everybody in this century and the 29th century.
Yeah,
right.
Indeed. I'm going to be offending people for the next 800 years.
Yay.
So also while we're talking about the guest stars, we talked about Ed Begley Jr. a little bit here. Now, what do you guys think about what I call Bill Jobs? Or sometimes I call him Steve Gates, but either way, I feel like he's modeled more after Steve Jobs, except that Chronoworks, I feel, is modeled more after Microsoft.
Yeah, definitely. Honestly, Ed Begley Jr. plays a great douchebag, and this episode was no different.
Did a nice job with that.
Yeah. Yeah, he really pulled it off. But you know what? He became like progressively more insane in this episode. But I think I can appreciate why they cast him, because I think he did a good job with the role that they gave him. I'm just not entirely certain that that he was quite the quality villain that they needed.
Hmm. I don't know. I thought he worked pretty well. I thought he played the malevolent sort of villain that I was talking about earlier, where Star Trek is very often missing a villain. There's either some ethereal thing or the villain's more comical, like Q. This is somebody who's actually evil and just out to defeat them and do whatever he can. And I thought it worked actually really well.
I find him pretty scary. That's a good point. I hadn't actually thought about that, but you're right. I mean, yeah. I did like the fact that he was sort of a classical movie villain where he would telegraph his plans before he pulled them off.
Right, that's true.
like he would totally explain his whole scheme and then he got really mad when it failed. It's like...
It's true, he did do that.
You posted all the signposts in your front yard, you know, so... And then you were surprised when the intruders, you know, came through anyway, so... Yeah.
I think the only things that don't work about Ed Begley Jr. for me is just the fact that it is TV and it was small budget, where Chronoworks apparently is him and his assistant. That's like
in that whole huge building, right? Yeah.
You know, with all of this money he only has one guy and then some girl he's paying. He's apparently not really that that loyal to him.
Yeah, you're right. He did seem to have a shortage on co-workers. Like, he didn't even have, like, an intern or, you know,
exactly.
Coffee ad or something.
Well, I did gather that he had a secretary named Dave or David, and then he had this guy Dunbar who goes out and, like, assassinates people for him with the weapon.
I wonder if Bill Gates has somebody like that who just carries a phaser around and shoots people whenever Bill Gates says to.
Probably.
If they bring an iPod onto the campus.
Yes, they're shot on site.
But Greg, that's
Bring
a good
the
point.
Weapon.
Talking about it being, you know, a small budget, for all the weird things about this movie, about the temporal prime directive, or about, you know, the mechanism for getting them to 1996 in the first place, one thing about this episode for me, though, is it is an example, what we get from time to time in Star Trek, an episode or a two-parter that would work really well as a movie. And I do feel that this, especially if they had more budget to pour into it, if you think of all the sets and the location shoots and the effects, if they could have done that on a big movie budget and stretch the story out to maybe 120 minutes, I think it could have made a very, very interesting movie and a more compelling movie than some of the movies that we've gotten in the Star Trek franchise.
I think that's an interesting point.
This is 14 times more entertaining than Insurrection. So.
That's true. I would watch a Future's End movie over Insurrection.
Yeah. In fact, yeah, that is a good point. This would have made an interesting, like, if it hadn't been a two-part episode, but, you know, they had advertised it as, you know, a TV movie where it would have been a full 2 hours long and, and then with, you know, without having to interrupt it to play the opening theme and the recap and whatever, as just one seamless, you know, like they did with Farpoint the first time. That, I think, would have been, that, I think, would have made it a cooler, you know, than seeing it in two parts.
I felt, one thing I want to mention in relation to that was they apparently had grand theme, grand ideas for this. They even thought at one point they'd do a four-parter, which just seems crazy. I don't think Star Trek has ever done that. I guess DS9 has been serialized from time to time. But I feel like they didn't quite have enough story, like to do an actual two-hour version or to do a feature film version. There just wasn't quite enough here. Like they ended up going to the... Who were they even? Like that Chakotay and...
Oh, I wanted to ask
and B'Elanna get caught by
this as well.
Like just some random like rebels off in the desert. Like where did that come from? Like why did was that in the story?
In the '90s, there were a number of cases. I guess it's always been around and it continues today. But I do remember in the '90s a number of cases of these militia groups, you know, in different parts, and they were usually in the West, like the Northwest or places out in the kind of rural areas. Who you know. It's the way it's presented here, though, it's really, really cliche. You know, like you're in the military, and the military's the federal government, and the federal government's the beast. And then Chakotay's like, I assure you, we're not from the beast. The line was very funny. But this element here, I mean, I kind of get what they were going for in isolation. And I have to think, especially today, if you are a half Klingon and a Native American, I think Arizona is the last place where you would want to crash your ship and be stranded.
That is probably true.
That is a good point. Yeah. But at any rate, definitely a good point.
It did feel like the story didn't need this element. This is like yet another thing we're going to throw in where it kind of took screen time away from the whole trying to stop Starling, and you know, maybe I would have rather have known what happened to Braxton. I don't know. This whole thing kind of felt shoved into the episode to just throw in one more element of being back in the past for the crew.
So I feel in the end the episode probably could have been just a one-parter. As we said, wasn't that our first episode of The Ready Room? It's a one-parter. So I think this episode could have very well just been a one-parter.
Yes.
They just wrap everything up in one bundle. Maybe if they had gone the feature film route with it, they could have made a better, like a fuller storyline. Maybe given Sarah Silverman and Tom Paris more of a romantic arc than they have time for.
Well, you know,
as much as I like the episode, I just feel like it drags at points. They forget what they're doing and they're just throwing more things at you, like bringing the doctor down and sending them to Arizona. It's like, no, I get it. Let's
like
just move on with the plot.
When Paris is trying to fix the radio and Tuvok brings them breakfast.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
At least that was amusing.
Know. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it
was
amusing, but in terms of elements where maybe the story drags, you know, if they did it like a feature film length, though, you could start out with the explosion in the 29th century. You could have a bit of that part of the story before...
Right.
Braxton suddenly comes out and tries
to
destroy
Voyager.
That's a good
point, yeah. They were sort of missing that. I mean...
Yeah, that's that one thing where, like we talked about with the DS9 episode. Which one was that? Where they go to the...
to past tense.
Is it San Francisco? Past tense.
Yeah.
You wanted to see the rest of the city. Like, what was it like? Like, what was the society really
like? Yeah, outside the walls of the sanctuary.
I want to see what the 29th century is like. I want to see this explosion. I want to see the devastation. I want to see it fixed. Like, I don't want to just see 1996. You know, Star Trek is about so much more.
I mean, I appreciated the breakfast thing. I mean, she walks up and, you know, or he walks up with the breakfast and she's like, what's up? He's like, breakfast is up.
Yeah, I know.
You know, that was like when they give Tuvok, you know, stupid comedy moments like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, more 29th century, less Arizona. And see, I think it worked as a two-parter. I don't know what they would have done if they tried to do a four-part. Like, even if they tried to stretch it into three parts, I think it totally would have lost the audience. It would have been like...
I'm not sure what they would have done with that.
Because even when Enterprise
actually touched on the eugenics war, you know, for a moment.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they could have slipped in something, anything about that.
Because the eugenics war, that was 1996, according to that.
Right.
You know, so, but yeah, nothing. It's like they come down and they're like, wait.
Well, they
can understand. Tuvok might have thought, oh my god, this must be eugenics. These are the dregs of society, looking at the people on that page. But at the same time, you know, they should have been looking for the superior beings, none of which they would have seen in this episode. So.
Right. But it could have been something as simple as, maybe the eugenics wars didn't affect Los Angeles, but it could have been something for fans as simple as there's a newspaper... They open a newspaper and there's a headline about the eugenics wars that are happening in Asia or just
throw something, you know,
but there's
like
no reference whatsoever to
maybe
it.
If they had said it in 1994 and they could have said that, you know, over in Europe they're doing eugenics experiments, just something, because you know what, two of you guys pointed that out, I didn't stop to think about that. I did not stop to think about that the year is the same time that the eugenics wars were going on. I just thought it was used, you know, sort of as comic relief and, you know, sort of commentary on life in 1996. Right. But now that you say that, I'm like, oh my god, this episode didn't work for me.
Yeah, I mean, it works for Star Trek IV, where they go back to 1986, because, 1986 in the Star Trek universe is basically the same. But once you start getting into the 90s and this decade, it's like you have to start showing what Star Trek was like.
You're right. At this time. You can't just do present day.
Well, for me, the fact that they don't include any reference to the eugenics wars, it doesn't hurt the episode for me. It doesn't take me out, you know, whether I believe the episode or I can get into it.
No, you're right.
I feel like
the episode for what it was. Missed opportunity, though.
But it is a missed opportunity. You just kind of feel like you want them to make sure that they connect all those elements of the Star Trek universe together.
Yeah, some kind of acknowledgement would have been nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I can enjoy it for what it was. Now that you guys have pointed that out, I'm just a lot more annoyed with it than I was.
Right.
Damn it.
Well, I should tell the listeners who, you know, obviously cannot see us because we only... distribute audio. Greg's name for this episode is Greg. West Coast don't care about no eugenics wars, Harbin.
Well, my theory is that like the whole East Coast has been taken over by warlords, but California's just like, we don't care.
Yeah, they're fine.
It's fine.
In college football, they talk about the East Coast bias. You know how people don't care about the Pac-10, Pac-12 teams. This is kind of like East Coast bias, but eugenics wars. You know,
right.
Khan, he just wasn't interested in the West Coast. He was all about Bristol, Connecticut.
Exactly. Which, this is the thing, like, you show us, like, okay, so when they were talking about doing a four-parter, they're talking about, like, doing, like, gangs, and I guess somebody gets trapped in a convenience store with, like, a gang coming after
them.
That's
Harry Kim. That's how he was going to die in this episode. That's how he's
gonna die. Yes! Yes!
So
there we go. See? Done. So easy.
So I feel like they were trying to like look at all these different aspects of America in 1996, you know, the Venice Beach culture, the gangs, the whatever
militia you groups,
the militias in Arizona.
Yeah,
you know, why can't we see the Star Trek thing for the fans? You know, just like show us briefly the Genix War. You know, have Harry say, you know, there appears to be, you know, fighting in Europe or something like that. I just feel it's another missed opportunity in one of these time travel stories where they only do the obvious and they never take the time to say how we can make this a little bit more connected, a little bit more detailed.
If they had done it as a four-parter, what I could see is that the first part is actually in the 29th century. It's the explosion. Mm-hmm. It's all that. And then what we see right now at the beginning, that's the second episode. And then the third episode is, you know, the conclusion, everything on Earth. And then the fourth episode could be, you know, repercussions. I don't know.
I thought the fourth episode could be just Braxton from the future lecturing them about the temporal prime directive for an hour.
Yeah, it's like you got a ticket, and when you go to renew your driver's license, they make you watch a video. So the crew, they have to go in this room and sit, and they just watch this video for 45 minutes. That's the episode.
Yeah.
Well, you
Janeway's
know,
exhausted, and Chakotay gives her a back rub at the end.
Exactly.
They would have enjoyed that. And the fans writing slash fiction, oh, they really would have liked that. But you know what? These episodes, as they were, couldn't have been stretched out anymore. But Chris, what you said, having some in the 29th century and having some of that explained instead of just talked as exposition but show us, I could have gone for that. That would have made a dynamite feature film.
That's the first rule of storytelling is show, don't tell.
But you know, what do you do?
Yeah, I know time constraints kind of take away from that, but sometimes Trek likes to talk a lot more than it should, I think. And this would have, this was probably one of those instances.
Maybe.
Well,
although
you know
that
what?
Just takes me back around to, JD, what you said about Insurrection. See, I actually like Insurrection quite a lot, but I like the talky nature of Star Trek. And so that movie, for me, works very well. But like you said, this is more exciting than Insurrection. And so in that sense,
Well, you know, I'll tell you what. The talk we've had here, Charlene, in a couple of months when we get around to these episodes on the Delta Quadrant, oh boy, there's going to be a whole lot more stuff, you know, that I'm going to bring up that...
Oh, yeah, and, totally.
So when Chris and Greg listen to that episode, they're going to be like, that seems really familiar.
Maybe, or, you know, Josh and Matt, I'm sure we'll have plenty else to say about it, and that'll throw a whole new kink into things, and
but,
we might talk
but
about
for
some...
my whole thing, I'm just going to channel Chris and Greg for it.
Yeah.
Nice. That'll be fun.
Make sure you do it like Data, and you actually use our own voice, too.
Oh.
I will have to work on that.
You got to.
Also, so one element we haven't brought up that I actually... it has lasting repercussions for the rest of the series is the fact that the Doctor gets his mobile emitter here, which I always forget. Every time I load up the episode, I forget this is the one where he actually gets the mobile emitter, and it becomes such a big part of his character. It changes his character. It's basically the equivalent of if Data had gotten his emotion chip in season 3 of TNG. It just completely, and I guess Rob Picardo was a little worried that it was going to change who he was. What did you guys think of the introduction of it and then how it affected the rest of the series?
You know, to be completely honest, I'm surprised they let him keep it. It's a piece of 29th century technology. What about the temporal prime directive there?
Well, the temporal prime directive doesn't apply when it benefits storytelling. That's the first rule of the temporal prime directive.
Silly me. I mean, the idea...
Yeah, your logic is just not quite called for.
I know. I need to lower my standards.
Yeah, exactly.
But the idea in and of itself is very cool because it's a completely new thing for the Doctor, and it's going to open up a whole new world of storytelling for him. And later on, of course, we see that it does. So in that aspect, okay, great. But my first reaction was... you can't do that.
Interesting.
So I was little dubious about that.
I think it's one of the great things about this episode, and And what I like about it is that when they created the character of the Doctor, I'm not quite sure what they were thinking to have. Obviously, you can't have a Star Trek show without having a Doctor, you know, as one of the main characters. So they conceive of the show where the Doctor is a hologram that can't leave sickbay. Mm-hmm. And that all sounds good, you know, on the back of a cocktail napkin, you know, when you're drinking and coming up the concept. But if you think about it, if you're going to do a mini series of like 4 or 5 shows, it's a great idea. But if you're going to do 7 years of a TV series, you can't have your main character stuck in one room for 7 years. So then they start coming up. Yeah, they start
coming
up with all these.
It's almost like they didn't really plan that well. It's like,
exactly.
It's like they got a few episodes in and they're like, wait.
Yeah.
Oh, crap. What are we going to do with the Doctor? And then he just languishes there for a while.
Yeah. So then they start coming up with these ideas that we're going to have a, you know, holographic emitters on the bridge and all things like that. But then this is a case where I think that the story offered them an opportunity very naturally to give him some piece of technology that could allow him to become a regular member of the crew and the cast.
Totally.
And so, you know, technologically, it doesn't make any sense. And in any other situation in Star Trek, they would have said, oh, you can't keep that because it's from the future. But it kind of works the way he got it by accident on a mission, and then he gets to keep it. I really liked that it worked out that way.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, why don't we start wrapping up our discussion here? And we talked about time travel and temporal prime directive, and of course, Sarah Silverman, because we had to talk about her, and the eugenics wars and the Doctor. So I think we, you know, covered all the big points here. And it's kind of interesting that I think that from our discussion, it may come off that we really didn't like this episode a little bit, whereas
yeah,
I actually,
you know,
like
we
this
have
episode.
That problem on the Delta Quadrant. We get to the end, we're like, wait, stop. We actually did like the episode. We're
we actually did like it.
Yeah, it's
so I actually like this episode quite a bit. But
I do too.
What are your final thoughts on this episode?
I want to watch it again. Honestly, I want to watch the episode again. It wasn't perfect, but it's just some parts that I want to go back to and just watch them and maybe just enjoy them, you know, just a little bit more.
Yeah.
Maybe not the crazy old homeless guy. Maybe I could skip that.
Right. For me, it's not as good as, say, Past Tense, but it's way better than Star Trek IV, and it's way better than a lot of these time travel episodes. And I think a lot of that just comes from back to the villain. One of the things they did on Voyager was come up with these great villains, a lot like, you know, how we had Khan go up against Kirk in Star Trek II. They started really doing that in Voyager with the guy from Year of Hell. I think Dark Frontier even had I guess it was just the Borg Queen. But I just feel like they had these big sweeps week episodes where you had this big danger to the crew that you really felt like it was real, and they did great casting as well. I loved Ed Begley Jr. in it, despite what Cliff Bull thought. I thought he did a really great job playing, as you said, a douche on the show.
Well, okay, here's a question. Did you like this episode better than Time Zero 1 and 2?
Yeah, probably for me. Yeah,
me too. I mean,
yeah.
I miss Guinan. I wish they'd found a way to put Guinan in 1996, okay? Because I'm just a Guinan fan. But the rest of those episodes, those two episodes,
yeah.
Oh, man. You know, they say you could take it or leave it. No, I would have left it and just kept Guinan. So, yeah, this was definitely more entertaining than that. So
there you go.
Well, Charlene, what are your last thoughts on Future's End?
I do like this episode, like you guys were saying. When we dissect episodes like this, it's easy to nitpick and make it sound more negative than I think we really see it overall. It's still an entertaining couple of hours of Voyager, despite its problems. It's fun to watch the crew in 1996 Los Angeles, and I do get a kick out of it. It's one that I kind of like to revisit every now and again.
Yeah, definitely for me too. All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, guys. Now, before we go,
thank
real quick,
you for having me.
We've already mentioned that you guys course, co-host the Delta Quadrant podcast.
Yes, we
along
do.
With Josh and Matt. So tell everyone real quick where they can find the Delta Quadrant if they want to have more great discussion. I mean, if you enjoyed our talk today about Future Zeon, you'll definitely enjoy the Delta Quadrant because they actually go through every episode of Voyager in order and talk about it. So tell us where to find you.
All right.
See, the URL is deltaquadrant.libsyn.com.
Yes.
And if you want to discuss that, if you listen to Treknologic, on their web board, we've actually got a section of the forum. But you know, Delta Quadrant, every once in a while, we'll do like a movie retrospective, where those debates get heated. Listen to the Generations podcast.
Yes, sometimes wow. they do.
It's like, wow, our blood was boiling for that one. But yeah, if you like Voyager and you're not listening to the Delta Quadrant, you should, because firstly, we're the internet's only Voyager podcast. And we analyze the episodes like we did here. And we give a rating at the very end. And sometimes you get a new appreciation for the episode. And sometimes you're like, man, that episode still sucks. Ex post facto, still sucks.
Oh, let's not get you on that, JD. We already did that once earlier this evening.
Yeah, indeed.
You can also find us on Twitter. We are...
oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah, Delta QUADT _cast. So if you want to find us there. And then we're also on Twitter with our personal accounts. I am Oh the Profanity.
And I am NFCJD.
And you can find Josh and Matt, too.
Well,
yeah, his is Josh from Mars.
Josh from Mars.
MHanson0207. So there you go. And if you follow the Delta Quadrant's Twitter, you can eventually find us all anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds good, guys. Well, we'll put links to those in the show notes so that everyone can just click right through. And again, it was great having you with us today.
Oh, thanks
yes,
for having
thank
me back.
You. This was awesome.
This is exciting.
I like this shit.
It's exciting.
Yeah. Can you get me a towel?
So Future's End really is one of my favorite Voyager episodes. So I'm really glad we got a chance to talk about it and very happy we got two people from Delta Quadrant on. Obviously, Charlene's friend of the show. Great to have JD on as well to discuss again what's one of my favorite episodes of Voyager.
Yeah, it is one of my favorite episodes too. And as we were saying at the end there, I think we may have come across a little bit harsh on it, but but as we often do when we talk about the movies or the episodes that we like so much, we do tend to be maybe a little bit harsher on them because there are certain elements that we think could have made the story even better. And I think it's definitely the case with Future's End. All right, Greg. Well, let's tell everyone how they can contact us if they want to share their thoughts on Future's End or anything else we talked about today, including all that commotion that Chris Pine is causing on the set over there of the next JJ film. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact, and you can send us a text message there. You can also find us on Twitter at username TrekFM, and you can find us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/TrekFM, and on Google Plus at hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. And then coming back to Twitter, Greg, everyone can find you on Twitter as well.
That's right. I've got my personal account, which is Greg Harbin, where I talk mostly about Battlestar, although I'm actually almost done. I'm like 5 episodes away from being finished with the series. It's quite shocking.
Wow.
So I don't know what I'm going to talk about after I'm done watching Battlestar.
So say we all.
Well, I'll make a few suggestions. I'll send you some iMessages with a few suggestions
Thank
of
you.
TV shows that you should watch, and then you can sprinkle in references to them throughout the Ready Room.
It's amazing how many, once you stop watching Battlestar and I start watching Farscape, I'm going to find all of these parallels between Star Trek and Farscape all of a sudden.
That's right, and then I'll have to get a new sound clip to play. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And we also encourage you to drop by our website, trek.fm. We've got all kinds of feature articles and games and trivia, wallpapers, all kinds of stuff up there. All right, Greg. Well, I'm going to go out and see if I can find some of that hollow dust that Starling was talking about in the episode, but we never saw.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick the temporal prime directive in it. Because the ready room is done.